Welcome to today's session on government, on journalism, and on hacking government. And to start off, we've got Jenny Duckett from gov.uk talking about publishing.
Okay, cool. Should I try and... You hear me? Yeah? Kind of? Yeah? Awesome. Great. Hello. I'm Jenny Duckett, as Francis said. I work for the Government Digital Service. I'm a developer on gov.uk. So gov.uk is the main government website. It's the single domain for government. Gov.uk launched in October 2012, and at that time it replaced DirectGov and BusinessLink. That's the orange one and the blue one, in case you remember. Since then, over 300 government organisations have moved their publishing activity onto gov.uk in a process called transition. And as part of that process, a lot of the old websites of those organisations were shut down. The reason behind that is that users shouldn't have to understand the internal structure of government in order to be able to interact with it and to find the information that they need. And we made sure that a lot of those websites now redirect to gov.uk so that the links continue to work. The guiding principle for transition has always been user needs rather than government needs. So where content on an old site met an identified user need, then either new content was created on gov.uk to replace it, or occasionally on other sites where that was more appropriate, or for reports or other publications from that organisation which needed to be preserved in their original formats, they were often imported onto gov.uk. And pages on the old sites that were related to that content that was moved onto gov.uk were redirected to the appropriate new URLs, and any content or pages on old sites that didn't meet an identified user need were archived. So I'm going to talk about the tools that we built at GDS to handle the traffic to those old sites themselves after they transitioned. So, since new content was written for gov.uk to meet valid user needs, why not just turn the old sites off and forget about them entirely? Well, there are links to all those old sites in a lot of places. For example, search engines, or on leaflets, on mugs, other promotional materials, or on pre-printed stationery, such as on the back of envelopes, or on letterhead. Other websites all around the internet, other government websites, private sector, charitable sector, for example, the Citizens Advice Bureau, and, of course, just user bookmarks in their browsers. And most of people's interactions with government are done out of necessity, not choice, often at difficult times and in challenging situations for them. And we need to make sure that users can still get to the information that they need wherever they're coming from, as well as being good web citizens by maintaining working links, because the integrity of the web is really important. So, we built the tools to ensure that we don't leave users hanging when they visit an old URL after that site has transitioned to gov.uk. But those tools that we needed to build needed to handle hundreds of transitioning sites across thousands of domains. So the general idea behind transition at a high level is that the organisation changes the DNS of the old site to instead point to gov.uk's redirection service instead of the servers where the old site was hosted, and then our service serves the redirects or the archive pages to end users. The initial tool that was built for the Direct Government Business Link transitions and was also used for the early 26 departments who transitioned onto gov.uk at the end of 2012, early 2013, was called Redirector. That was a lot of CSV files, quite big ones, with mappings from old URLs to their new behaviour, either a new URL to redirect to or the fact that it was an archive. And then all of those CSVs were managed together with Perl scripts in particular orders, overwriting each other in particular complicated ways. And then with make files generating other make files, generating big bundles of Nginx web server configuration that then could be deployed to a server to serve those responses. So that system was built quickly, and it worked for those transitions, but it had some disadvantages. Changes to mappings to change the behaviour of old URLs or to make sure that we were handling ones that we'd missed early on could only be made if they were in the CSV file, so changes could only be made by people at GDS. they were PostgreSQL files in a Git repository. That's not a great tool for most non-developers, even if they had access to it. Also, the system needed to be deployed periodically to get those changes live. So there was an inevitable delay in fixing things quickly when we noticed they were broken. And also, after those, that initial set of transitions, it was already hundreds of thousands of lines of Nginx configuration. And we knew that that wouldn't scale for the 300 plus other agencies and arm's length bodies that were going to transition onto GWK. That's hundreds more sites, both performance-wise and also the workflow of maintaining those mappings. So the team that I was on built some new applications to use instead of that system. We've got Transition, which is a Ruby on Rails app. That is an application, it's a back-end admin application that is used by users in government to create and maintain those mappings. And that writes to a database, and there's a small Ruby rack app called Bouncer, which reads from that database and serves the responses for URLs on the old sites. So after we'd built these tools and they were live, we migrated all the sites that had been handled by Redirector over to the new system gradually, so that the old system Redirector is no longer in use now. It's just these. So the advantages of doing it this way instead, there's quite a few of them. We've got a web application that can be used by people in departments and agencies to maintain the mappings themselves. That means there's no bottleneck in GDS to get things live. They can do it all themselves. Also, at the same time as they're deciding what to do with the content, they can work on the mappings then as well, rather than doing it all at the last minute just before they transition. Because the data is going straight into a database and being read from there immediately, any changes that they make in the transition tool go live immediately or within about an hour because there's an extra caching layer in front of Bouncer. But there's no need for developers to be involved in that process. It all just happens. This system also scales much better and is more stable than a large amount of Nginx configuration. From a developer's point of view, Ruby and Rails are much more standard tools that we work with. On GovUK, the vast majority of applications that we've built are Ruby on Rails. So in terms of having people around who can maintain it, build new features, iterate, fix bugs, deal with any issues, that's much more maintainable for us than CSVs and Perl and Makefiles, which is a very custom solution. And finally, one really important advantage of having a web application to deal with this is that we can present traffic data to users about so they can see what's happening to their old sites after they transition to help them create and maintain mappings and fix errors. So I'm just going to run through a quick guided tour of the transition tool. This is the homepage. It's just the big long list of all the organizations who are managing sites through the transition tool. And if we go into one of them, this is the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. They have a lot of sites. They had a site for pretty much every embassy in the world. There were 160-odd of them that transitioned early on. All the dates are over there. They were mostly early 2013. And then if we go into the main FCO site at the top up there, this is a site dashboard for that site. There are the links to where you can create and edit mappings, to the traffic data that I talked about. This table, you can't quite see at the bottom there, is a list of all of the domains that are handled by the tool, and they're all treated identically as part of this site, but many domains are handled for that, and you see how long it's been live there. So if you were to click on the mappings link at the top up there, then you go to a big long list of mappings like this. You can filter by various fields, as it's filtered a bit, and the count updates when you filter. And if I zoom in a little bit more, maybe you can read a bit more, maybe less, actually. I'll go back. In the table here, you've just got all of the mappings. So you've got an example of a redirect, and then the new URL that's going to redirect to. And this one, the fact that it's an archive, and there are various bulk editing functionality there to manage lots of mappings at once. And then if you want to edit an individual mapping, you get a form like this where you can enter the URL that it should redirect to or switch it to be an archive and fairly self-explanatory at that point. So mapping is not an exact science. It's really difficult to find all of the URLs on those old sites for a variety of reasons. The structure of the old site may have changed several times already in the past, and broken links may already exist there. Some of these department sites have been around for a good few years, they've been reorganized several times, they haven't taken that same level of care at those points, And so there are URLs out in the world already that didn't map to existing content. How do you find them? How do you know what to do with them? You might hope that getting the server logs would be the gold standard of the perfect source of data from those old sites to find out what they've got, what people visit. That's true for what people visit, but there are some pages that were on those old sites and needed to be there and needed to be preserved on WK that never showed up in server logs or in Google Analytics for those old sites. They might be things the organization has a statutory obligation to publish, or they could be massive public record, but things that are actually very rarely looked at in practice but still need to be there, and it's important that we keep them and make sure that they redirect to the right places. It's also difficult to understand old URLs on the old sites because a lot of them used content management systems that generated really horrible URLs with weird query strings where it was totally opaque. You didn't really know what the content was referring to by looking at the URL. They would generate duplicate URLs for the same piece of content, and trying to find all of those, work out which was which, what they all referred to, try to make sure where they all go to the right place is really difficult. We learned really early on in the transition process that the people who know the content and the subject area best should make the decisions about what the user needs are, what we should redirect, how we should redirect, what exactly which things are relevant, how they should go, and which things should be archived. We use various sources of data to help agencies find their old URLs and their old sites. We used site crawls, site maps, data from their Google Analytics. We did manage to get log files from the servers of the old sites before they transitioned in quite a few cases. It was really difficult to get them. We spent months and months negotiating, going backwards and forwards with lots of organizations individually, trying to persuade them that the limited fields that we wanted out of their logs, we wanted nothing personally identifying at all, was okay to give us. And even once we got their agreement in principle that it was okay, getting through their suppliers down to the people who actually had access to servers to get that data to then get it to us. It was quite a convoluted process, but it was really worth it because that really was valuable data, and that was really helpful to have. We gave users in government organizations access to the transition tool well in advance of their transitions so that they had time to work on those mappings and make sure that they were all set up ready to go on the day the site transitioned. This is a drawing by Paul Downey, who is here today. I'm not sure if he's in the room. He was a technical architect on transition, and he drew this about charting content, and that refers to lots of the sources of data that I just mentioned. These are the analytics pages. They're a really crucial part of the transition tool for agencies after transition, because we encourage them to check back frequently to make sure that they were seeing what's going on here and fixing any problems that arose. These pages give government users the information that they need to be able to fix errors. And they can add missed mappings in case something's 404, or perhaps catch missed user needs. If we see a particularly high volume of traffic for a page that we've archived, then maybe that's an indication that actually people do need that content and we should consider redirecting it to somewhere more useful, or rewriting that content, presenting it in a different form. So the data that is displayed on these pages is processed out of the server logs from the content delivery network that sits in front of Bouncer. The data is updated hourly, so it's you see it very soon. You can detect quite quickly when there's a problem. You can view the data over various time periods and by different categories of response statuses. There's then big tables of all of the URLs, URLs that have been requested. In this case, these ones were originally 404-ing. This is a graph of a long time period. They were originally 404-ing, but now those errors have been fixed. They're now redirecting. So this is a really good example of traffic over time, this site. This is the original communities, part of the communities and local governments website. They transitioned quite early on. This graph goes from January 2013 up until now. You can see here at the start there's a big, quite high levels of red, that's errors, 404s, early on. They transitioned early on using the old redirector tool. They didn't have this data available to them at the time when they transitioned, so they didn't know how to fix these things themselves.
You can see here that goes suddenly the red goes down a lot and then down again to pretty much nothing there. That would have been a exploit of redirect to the old tool where suddenly mappings were added. This graph is also a really good example of the fact that traffic doesn't really decrease very much over time for these sites. Even 2 years after transition, it's gone down a bit, but not that much. We're still getting over 30,000 requests a day for this site. It's really important that both we keep this running and that government users come back to try and fix these if to make sure there aren't any errors that have suddenly appeared. One more example of a really shorter time period. This is the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency site. They transitioned through the transition tool. They had this data available. They transitioned on this day. One day later, the red is a little bit higher, but then it's straight back down again the next day. There was one URL that had been missed. They were able to use this data to see that really quickly and to fix the error so that it was not erroring anymore and users got redirected to somewhere more useful. So what do you see now if you visit a URL on an old site after transition as an end user? There are three types of responses that Bouncer serves. The first one is a redirect. There's not really much to show you for a redirect. If you visit this URL, you'll get redirected to this URL with the 301 HTTP status code. It's moved permanently, so it should be considered as a permanent status. For an archive, you'll see a page like this. We use the 410 HTTP status code for this. It's gone. Again, that's a permanent status. But these pages are not a dead end. There's a link to the National Archives there. When the National Archives regularly crawls all government websites quite periodically, and before a site transitioned, we would get the organization to pick a crawl from the National Archives that best covered that whole site, and we would use a timestamp from that crawl to generate these links on this page. And there's also the option to override that for individual URLs in the transition tool for ones that are more appropriate for that. There's also a link to the department's new homepage on GovUK, and also, really importantly, a link to a contact form on GovUK. So if you've got any feedback about any individual URLs of these, it'll be really great to see them. And then, if you click on the link to the National Archives I showed you, then you would get through to this page here. So this is the original content that was on that site before. This was a consultation from Department of Transport from 1997 about bull bars. That content is still available there on the National Archives site with the banner up there. And the third type of response that Bouncer will serve is a 404 page. You'll get this if you try to visit a URL that we don't know about. But actually the pages are very similar to the archive pages. They've got pretty much the same links. And remember that requests that do 404 will show up in those analytics pages so that they can be found and fixed by government users. The vast majority of requests that are handled by Bouncer are served from mappings. But we also have a couple of other ways of handling requests, which we chose to use in a few particular cases. One of those is that we can create rules in code in Bouncer like this, using regular expressions, which we can use instead of mappings to redirect particular small subsets of paths. An example that we chose to use this for was the Environment Agency's flood alerts. There is the content on government websites. It varies in importance from it's kind of nice to know to people will may or may die if they don't get this information at the time when they need it. And flood alerts are relatively high up on that scale. So we thought this was important content that we should make sure that users definitely get redirected to the right place for these. And in this case, it's going to be particularly difficult to create mappings accurately for all of these URLs. There are on the old site, you could search for flood alerts by your postcode or your river, your region, county, the severity of the flood threat, and all the possible URLs that could be generated by all the possible combinations of those. There were going to be many thousands, and it was going to be really, really difficult to map all of those individually. In this case, we could do it programmatically with regular expressions. So in this case, users will just get redirected to the Environment Agency's new location for those flood alerts, and they will all work fine without having government users having to do that themselves. A thing that we handle specially are sitemap paths. The sitemap.xml is the standard path for sitemaps, and Bouncer will generate sitemaps for all of the old sites using all of the mappings that are redirects. Serving those sitemaps really helps search engines to discover the new content so that they can update their indexes, get users to the right place sooner. One quick point about canonicalization. We canonicalize URLs so that a single mapping can handle a lot of variations on a single URL. On most old sites, all of these different kinds of variations on the same URL ended up serving the user the same content. There's no need to map them all separately or make it harder to maintain. So we have code that will do things like, in general, most of the time ignoring the query string, except when it's a particular parameter marked significant for that site. We drop trailing slashes, fragments, we lowercase everything, and encode certain character sequences so that a single mapping can be used to handle all those URLs. That means less work for government users to maintain those mappings, and also it's a better experience for end users because it's much more likely that the particular link that they click on is going to match a mapping, and therefore they're going to get a redirector of 410 rather than a 404. And that code is in a gem that is used consistently across the transition tool and Bouncer. Some big numbers. Now, after those 300 organizations have transitioned, Transition and Bouncer handle 700 sites across about 1,500 domains, and we've got 450 users across government maintaining nearly 2 million mappings, and on average we serve about 4 billion responses per day for all of those transition sites. That's a lot of things. By the middle of last year, these hundreds of organisations had transitioned successfully, including some of the biggest ones. We'd had a lot of positive feedback from users around government about using the transition tool. We'd done user research all the way through developing the transition tool, and we just iterated it as a result. And our later user research showed that users found it straightforward to maintain their mappings using the tool. From the start of working on it, there'd been features that we'd planned to build, and we'd always assumed that we would need to build them in the end. But actually, we found that our users didn't need those features, and the tool already did everything that they needed in order to transition successfully, and we'd already done the hard work to make it simple for them. So, in summer last year, we declared the transition tool feature complete. This is quite an unusual thing to be able to do with software. It's pretty rare to be able to define a point at which a thing is really doing enough and it's finished, even though it's still in use. So I think we were able to do this because our team had a really clear mission. We were able to focus on doing one thing and the autonomy to decide how to do it. And we were able to build these tools to help government users, help end users get the information they need wherever they're coming from. And just some links to finish off. All of the code I've mentioned is on GitHub, available under the MIT license. There's links there to a couple of blog posts about the principles behind transition. Earlier this year, we had a freedom of information request for all of the URLs handled by the transition tool. The response to that is published on GovUK. So if you go and look at that URL, then there's a big CSV of all of the mappings that were in the tool back in January. And finally, a link to these slides. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jenny. That was great. Next, we've got on the subject of open source journalism, and Lydia, who is in the program, is ill today, and Annabelle has agreed at the last minute to speak instead. So thank you, Annabelle.
I'll try and keep this brief. So as you know, I'm not Linda, I'm Annabelle Chich. I'm a former Open News Fellow, and Linda is a current Open News Fellow, and the reason why we're talking about open source journalism is because we're kind of in it. And we're interested in it. So I started out my path on journalism by working at The Guardian as a computer programmer, as a developer, sitting building tools for them to help them enable their journalists to get out the journalism that they wanted. And then I became an Open News Fellow. I applied, and I got in. And there were only 8 of us that year, and there are another handful this year, and there'll be another handful next year. And at the end of this, I will tell you why maybe you could tell your friends to apply to be an Open News Fellow too. So what is this whole open source journalism thing? Open source and journalism, open source journalism. There's two things, really. One is there's a transition in a lot of industries to try and produce code that other people can use. That would be the open source bit. And journalism is doing it too. They're on the bandwagon, mostly, more or less. sometimes, occasionally. Places like The Guardian and The New York Times and a few other leaders in industry are trying to publish a few more tools out into the wild that everyone can use under these licenses like MIT that Jenny mentioned earlier. And there are organisations and groups and collections of people that are trying to help move the industry a little bit further forward. One of these groups is OpenNews. They're funded by the Knight Foundation. They're run by the Mozilla Foundation, Knight being a journalism foundation, Mozilla being a technology foundation, and they do a bunch of things under this funny Open News banner. One of those things is they run fellowships where they drop computer programmers into newsrooms around the world, and they work together and individually with their newsroom and with other communities in order to create tools that they can push out into the world for free, open. Sometimes not free, just open. The other thing is there are other communities in this domain that are also working to close the gap between journalism and technology, getting journalists together in the same room as computer programmers, helping everyone understand what the needs are and what can be done to help create journalists who can manipulate CSV files and work with spreadsheets and scan and extract information from documents, and to get computer programmers building tools that are actually needed by the journalism community. Some of these groups are running here. There's one called Hacks and Hackers in London. It also runs in Berlin, a bunch of other cities all around the globe. If you ever drop into a city and you want to know what this whole journalism technology thing is, look up your local chapter and go along. They run often once a month and they're all community driven, and you can join in too. So journalism is changing. Data journalism, this thing where we do freedom of information requests against government and get back PDFs and then try and make journalism out of it, is the cool new thing. If you want to get data out of PDFs, you can do it. There's a tool out there called Tabula that was built by one of the Open News fellows that takes data out of PDFs and allows you to manipulate it in your favorite spreadsheet tool. There are lots of other tools. There's lots of other kinds of journalism. There's crowdsourced journalism. There's open source journalism. Journalism where we ask the people outside of the newsroom to contribute. Like Free the Files, done by ProPublica, or MP's Expenses, done by The Guardian, where we ask the people to help us do a thing that is hard for a computer to do. And there are tools being built now. One of the fellows from last year built a tool called CrowData that helps this kind of thing happen for a newsroom that just wants to do it but doesn't want to build the tool themselves. The Open News program doesn't just run these crazy fellowships, and I do say crazy, it's 10 months of chaos where you drop into different communities and you try and understand all the things that are going on and you get people together and you make things and you teach things. But they also do programs around education. They have a website called Source, which they try and push out information on new and great open source tools that can help journalism. They run code convenings, which allows organizations to open source tools that they would otherwise keep closed because of resources or politics, sometimes money. And in this crazy community of people all trying to build things and do right by journalism is an explanation of why you would need this kind of open source collaboration. So we need more computer programmers to take interest in the kind of programming for social good, and journalism is one of those domains which we need more people. And journalism needs a lot of exploration. We need to get information out of crazy file formats. We need to understand what all of this crazy data is. We need to present it to people so that they can understand what's going on, because just dumping stuff on a screen is often not the best way of going about it. And we need to kind of explore new storytelling so that we aren't just creating large article archives for our readers. I now work outside of The Guardian and outside of Open News doing the same thing, but just for little groups of people to try and help them. I don't really have anything else to say, but join the Open News Fellowship if you're a crazy programmer and you want to get dropped into a newsroom. If you want to understand more about journalism and technology and all of these things and this open source stuff, ask me questions and I will endeavour to answer them.
We can do 5 minutes of questions because that was...
Hello. Do you have any experiences of dropping into BBC newsroom?
Not personally, but there was a fellow in my year, Noah Veltman, who did just exactly that. He dropped into BBC newsroom and built tools and did lots of mapping things for them. If you want more, I can tell you.
What do you think of using Wikipedia as a home for news? It's got a big kind of news section where people read it. What do you think of using it as a place for news?
Is there another one?
This one.
Will it work now?
Should it?
Sorry.
Okay. Well, sure. I think that anywhere where you can... validate, authenticate, and verify the source of your news, just put it there, no problem. Wikipedia, okay, go for it. Trouble with Wikipedia, maybe, is that you cannot understand the context of a story as it's happening necessarily. Perhaps understanding the historical context of that story in Wikipedia is a little bit hard. What you'll find is that people might go to Wikipedia or the BBC or something to kind of understand the context of a story that they've missed, and then they might go to, like, The Guardian or the New York Times or something to get a kind of opinion piece or some deeper in-depth analysis which has a bit more of a kind of explanation of the context of that thing in that society. So Wikipedia, sure, as a part, as yet not a whole.
Competing aspects of journalism could include stuff like the phone hacking scandal. So do you think that journalists, supposing that they feel some ethical inclinations, have got practical ways to escalate to their management what their concerns are and prevent some of these abuses taking place?
My experience in newsrooms is that regardless of whether you're talking about ethical decisions or just plain technical decisions, that at the moment, journalists don't know where to go to escalate these kinds of things. And you maybe have to be in a lucky position to know the right person to talk to about resolving any of your particular issues. Bigger the newsroom, the harder it is. Most journalists don't work on problems that require such ethical considerations. And those that do, I think, are now much more aware in the industry than they were, say, 2 years ago.
Do you have one more question?
Hi, I've been just hearing about Open News. I wonder, it must be an amazing kind of experience to be dropped into the newsroom, and I wonder if there's anything particular about the difference in culture between, say, programming or working in newsroom that particularly was difficult or you would not expect to be.
So I've worked in 3 countries now, New Zealand, which is where I'm from, the UK, which is where I spent 10 years, and Germany. And I would say that the cultural miscommunication between technologists and journalists is smaller than the miscommunication that can occur between countries. However, I think that the gap is closing. So just in the last 2 years, the number of groups that run around this topic of technology and journalism just in Germany, just in Europe, is increasing faster and faster. There's huge numbers of groups opening every year, I think. Last year, I noticed maybe 4 or 5 more hacks and hackers-like groups opening just in Germany alone. So I think there's a huge awareness that has been raised and changed by the last couple of years of this crazy journalism thing. I think, though, it's always the people that are interested that find out the solutions to their problems, and that these journalists who have a problem might discover that technology is a solution. And those are the people that turn up to these groups to kind of discover, you know, like, how do I solve a problem that I actually have today? What tools are there available? Is there someone who can help me out to do this? And a journalist who isn't solving those problems is not going to see a need in industry for technology or for these groups or for any of these things. There's only a very small number of journalists that are actually working and actually interested and able to participate in this kind of journalism. So if you look at NICAR, which is the Computer Assisted Reporting Conference that occurs in the US, which is at the moment, I guess, the largest market for this kind of journalism as it stands, has only 1,000 people turn up to it in any one year, which is, I guess, not an indication of everybody, but if you see the same 1,000 people every time you turn up to these conferences, then you know that you're probably getting a large proportion of the market represented. It's growing, and it's huge now compared to what it was 5 years ago. If you just, I don't know if this is maybe a German reference, but there's a conference that runs in Germany. It's almost exclusively for a kind of hardcore computer programming communities called Chaos Communication Congress. There are 12,000 people now. 4 years ago, there were somehow only 2,000. So I think we're changing. I mean, I don't know what it means. Come back to me in 5 years. I don't know.
Thank you, Anna. Finally, in this session, we have Terence Eden on how... Well, we've got to stop him keeping back in government now.
One of the things that I think is quite important to realise before I go any further is that hacking computers, especially government computers, is a crime. Do not do it. So what I now require everyone to do is to please stand. Everyone stand. I know you've been sat down for ages. There we go. I require you to hold up your right hand, place your left hand on your chest or any other part of your body you hold dear. Try not to drop your phones or microphones. And repeat. Ah, that's almost close enough. I'll tell you what, if you... let's just wiggle this in here. Let's see if we get that. And just repeat after me. I solemnly swear...
solemnly swear...
that I am up to no... No, that I... that I will respect the Computer Misuse Act, and will not conduct any naughtiness, and furthermore, I hereby promise not to bring proceedings against the presenter of today's presentation. Well, that's all been caught on tape, so thank you very much. You may sit. I think we're just about... Oh, you know what? Let's try this in purple. Can we hear...
I noticed Jenny didn't swear.
We'll have to see. Right, well, we have absolutely no colours on this presentation. So what I'm going to do is we'll just pull this out and try again in just 1 second. How many people here have used a .gov.uk website? Just give me a show of hands or a brief cheer. How many people here have used an NHS.uk website? Give me a cheer. Slightly less cheerful than that. You know, the NHS is a great institution. So, I don't know why we're purple. Try turning it off and on again. As we heard earlier, the government used to run hundreds and thousands of different websites, and very slowly, and with great effort by the GDS team who are here, you know, they've reduced that. But there are still lots and lots of... if anyone else has a laptop and wants to bring this up, my presentation's on USB stick. Now, the problem with running websites... just hands up if you run a website. Yeah. Running a website... is hard. I mean, it is actually really hard. You've got to, you've got to build the thing, and then you've got to keep the server physically secure, then you've got to make sure the software all works, and there's all sorts of intricate bits, and really, running a website is a job best left for a specialist. Has anyone in the front row got a laptop which is on? We'll give this a quick go. Wonderful, MacBook is almost certainly... Oh, no, it's working! Right, okay, all right, this is very exciting. No one breathe on anything. We'll just drag that across, we'll press it, Right. Evidently, GCHQ have been listening. Big round of applause for the tech team here. GCHQ have been listening and have been intercepting this. Like I say, running a website is hard, and computer security is hard. You know, people get degrees in it. It's not something that you can just tack on at the end. It's not like, oh, I'm going to annoy my designer friends here. It's not like designing a logo. It's not like at the end you go, can I have a logo? There you go. So like, you can't say, can I have security? One of the big, there's a website called OWASP, O-W-A-S-P, which lists the top 10 common vulnerabilities for computer software. And if you can knock out those top 10, you're basically, you're reasonably safe against...
Didn't they give up on the top 10 and called it top 20?
Yes, they may well have done. if you can knock out the top 10 or 20, you are probably safe from some of the easiest hacks. Now, one of the easiest hacks that we see is what's called code injection SS. Basically, let's say you go to a search engine and you type in the word hello, and it will come back saying, we're sorry, we couldn't find any results for the word hello. Okay, well, it's echoing back the text that you typed in. So if you were to type in some JavaScript in that search box, it should come back and say, I'm sorry, we can't find, and then print the JavaScript out so you can read it. But some websites are misconfigured, and what they do is they see the JavaScript and say, oh, well, I'll put that in the page, and then I'll render it as code and show it to the user, which allows you to do things like this. So this is this is Parliament's website, and there we have our glorious leader declaring martial law. Now, the first thing I should say is the people at Parliament, I responsibly disclosed this to them, I think, on a Thursday night, and by Friday morning they'd fix it. They were really quick at spotting this. You know, absolutely full kudos to them. Possibly shouldn't have done it, you know, late at night on a Thursday. I caused someone some sleepless nights, but, they, you know, they were brilliant. But you find lots and lots of government websites are like this, and they contain flaws. And now Parliament runs its own website, but... the Department for Education outsources EduBase. So anyone who's in schools will know about EduBase. Big database, lets you query every single thing about every single school. And it's run by a company called Texuna. And they let me do this to their website. A big thanks to Underground Magazine who for supplying that story. Now, the problem here with Texuna is that I discovered this problem and I sort of sent them an email. I didn't hear anything back, and I rang them up, and they went, what? I went, there's a problem on your website, and I described it. Oh, yeah. And I spoke to the Department for Education. Oh, you need to speak to the people who run our website. And it sort of went ping-pong back and forth for a couple of weeks, with no one sort of taking responsibility for this, until a journalist from the Times Education Supplement rang them up and said, got this weird chap, Terence Eden, on the phone, and we want to publish a story about... And surprisingly, it was fixed the next day. Journalists are quite useful sometimes. The police aren't immune either. This photo supplied by the wonderful Paul Clark. He does great photos. Look him up. This is sort of really simple stuff. You pass a bit of code. You can probably see in the address bar at the top what the code is. Now, of course, you can send that as a link to people. And you can see with the police, that could be really quite concerning. You know, if someone sends you a link and all of a sudden it says wanted for arrest and there's your picture and everything. There's nasty stuff you can do with this. Okay, so that's funny. That was the satire portion of the talk. But I want you to imagine that you are a member of the House of Lords. Give me a good lordish name, Annabelle. Lord Annabelle, there we go. So you're Lord Annabelle, and you receive, or Lady Annabelle, I suppose, and you receive an email. We've all received this email. It's from the IT department. You need to update your password? Bloody hell, okay. And you go to the Parliament website, and this is what you see. Now, to you and I, who are reasonably intelligent and technologically savvy people, not that the people in the House of Lords necessarily aren't, but, you know, you see a username and a password field, and you hit submit on that, and before you know it, your password has been sent off to Russia or Rupert Murdoch or anyone beginning with the letter R. There's some really nasty things you can do when sites like this aren't secure. And it gets worse. So there you can inject stuff in, but some government websites have been so insecure that hackers and criminals have been able to upload all sorts of things, so malware, pirated software and movies and things. And it turns out that the most profitable thing for hackers to do nowadays is sell counterfeit UGG boots. So this is the London Borough of Hillingdon. And the URL there is... course ID 1234. Their website was so insecure. Now, again, I spoke to them, and after a bit of back and forth, which we'll get onto, they finally fixed this. But this is... The great thing about this, if you're a hacker, is if you send out spam, you know, Google and everyone, very good at looking at spam, definitely spam. If you send out spam and it's got a GovUK link in it, that's really high trust. Really high trust. And it also works for search engines as well. So this is land registry. Someone's managed to hack into that and put in the source code. So no one's actually going to see adverts for Louis Vuitton handbags on the land registry, but Google will crawl it and go, oh, the land registry, which is a highly ranked government trusted page, is pointing to these dodgy handbags. We'll zoom them up the Google charts. Other search engines are available, but vastly inferior. This is a part where I'm going to teach you some of the secrets, the tools of the trade. I'm going to ask you, please, not to tweet the next slide or take any photos of it, because security. So there's this cool new website, which is called Google. Now, I don't know how many of you have heard of it. What Google allows you to do is, you know, if you do a search for cats, it will search the whole web for cats. If you do a search for cats and then do site bbc.co.uk, it will search the BBC for cats. So you can do that with GovUK and NHSUK. So here, I've done a search for Viagra, a very popular pharmacological product, I'm told. And here we go. This is Tame Town Council. Anyone from Tame? No. Lots and lots of their pages have been replaced with adverts for dodgy blue pills. And you can go and you can run this search right now for Ugg Boots, NHS.UK, or Police UK, or any or MOD UK, and you will still find things like this going on. Okay, so there's a little more than that. I did a study last year of the NHS websites. So anyone from NHS here today? Or Department for Health? Phew. So the first things first is, does anyone know how many .nhs.uk websites there are? Just give me a shout out. Give me a number.
1,000?
500? 10,000? Yeah, it's something like that. It's like 5,000 or 6,000. I mean, there's loads and loads of them. And because every time someone pops on and goes, we want to run, like, stop smoking. Okay, well, you can have stopsmoking.nhs.uk. We want to run, you know, West Midlands get your corns treated.nhs.uk. Okay, well, you can have that. And these websites go live, and then no one actively manages them. So how do you get a list of all 5,000 NHS UK websites? You go to whatdotheyknow.com, and you find that Rob Alley, I don't know if he's here today, has already submitted an FOI request, which NHS replied to, and here's 5,000, 10,000 NHS websites. Then I ran a tool which is called WP Scan. This is an open source tool. You can tell it's a proper hacking tool because it looks like that. It's all green text. What this does is really simple. This just looks for vulnerabilities in WordPress sites. So what it does is it loads up the front page of actiononsmoking.nhs.uk. And if you run a WordPress site, it will say in the header, I'm WordPress version 4.03. And WP Scan looks at that, looks up in a database and goes, oh, WordPress version 4.03 is vulnerable to these things. And, oh, the website has told me it's got these plugins and that version of the plugin is vulnerable to that problem there. And so there were something like 10,000, at least 10,000 different flaws I found in the NHS websites. Now, just give me a cheer if you use WordPress. Yeah. Everyone loves WordPress. The NHS loves WordPress, and why not? It's a brilliant service. But this is a distribution of the versions of WordPress that the NHS was running last year. I'll stress this last year. I did this scan when version 3.81 had been out for a week or so. And there were a good sort of 50 sites which had updated to the latest version and a few which were on a few before. But you go right down the bottom, there were, and there still are, .nhs UK WordPress sites running ancient versions, 2.6.1, which I think came out in 1805, and is steam-powered. It's frightening that these sites have been set up and then forgotten. And this is a large part of what I'm talking about, is that, you know, we had no top-down reorganisation of the NHS. The government was very keen to say that. But what's really happened is there was a top-down reorganisation of the NHS. And so who runs this site that was set up by this care commissioning group or this primary care trust, which no longer exists? No one knows. Now, I'm picking on WordPress unfairly. So this is amazingbreastmilk.nhs.uk. Which, as you can see there, is subject to this XSS thing. So now it says, buy Nestle, because Nestle baby formula is so much better for you than breast milk. It's not, by the way. So, does anyone know who runs this site?
You
do. I have the power.
No, this is a serious question. Who runs this site?
The donor.
No one knows. I mean, literally no one knows. I rang up the Department of Health and showed them this and went, this is a serious problem. People can do all sorts of things with this. And they went, we're just a Department of Health, mate. We don't run websites. It's like, what? You run the NHS? Yeah, don't do this, mate. I mean, they're a bit more polite than that. So I found the sort of, I looked in the whois, I found the designers, and I rang them up, and they went, well, we were just given the contract to design it. We handed it over. We weren't given the maintenance contract. I rang the person who's supposedly doing it and went, well, I don't work for that part of the NHS anymore. So, and round and round. And for a year and a half, this website has been there, not being updated as far as I can tell, and just free to sort of spew out spam. And again, with NHS ones, this is quite disturbing, I think. This is Norwich CCG Care Commissioning Group .nhs.uk completely taken over to sell pills. Now, if the hacker was actually half decent, you could make that look like a proper NHS page selling. As it is, it's a generic buy Viagra and all sorts of other potency pills. But that's a live NHS website right now that today you can go to and buy Viagra and Cialis and antifungals and God knows what else on there. It's depressing and scary. So this is a genuine trigger warning. The next bit is contains death and child abuse and all sorts of horrible things. If you want to step outside, please do so. So some of you will probably remember the little girl, Victoria Colombier. She was brutally murdered by her guardians. And there was a huge public investigation, and we spent millions of pounds, quite rightly, looking into the failings of social services and everything else. And we set up a website, well, the government set up an independent website, which detailed all the recommendations that they made. The website today points to injury claims lawyers. They forgot to renew the domain. I don't know what a .org.uk domain retails for. It's like a fiver. So for sake of 50, 500 quid, they could have had this registered in perpetuity. They didn't. It's now been taken over. Some of you will have heard of Harold Shipman, possibly the UK's most prolific serial killer. Again, huge public inquiry. How did he get away with this? What lessons can be learned? If you go to theshipmaninquiry.org.uk, which is printed in all sorts of newspapers, and, you know, it's part of the public record, discussed in Parliament. Claims action talk. Some scumbag, and I don't feel it's libelous to use that word, some scumbag has registered this lapsed domain and pointed it here. Dr. David Kelly allegedly killed himself after being outed as a person who said that the government had sexed up their dossier on the Iraq war. No. That's what the Hutton inquiry points to now. The Bloody Sunday, we spent 190 million quid on the inquiry, quite rightly again, but where did the Bloody Sunday inquiry website no longer exist? There's a version of it backed up on the National Archives, but the domain has been snatched up by someone else. Similar, this is the light relief portion of this bit of the talk, which is the Butler Review was set up to look into whether there was just cause to go to war. The Butler Review is now literally a review site. I mean, I'll take my hat off, that's quite good, but... So the main problem with all of this is an absolute lack of accountability. So as I said, with the NHS, no one knows who runs these websites. So half of them, the people have gone. I mean, there's a website which presumably is being paid by someone still running. There have been local governments who sort of set up parish town council websites, and they don't really have the expertise to do that. And the NHS, you know, we see local doctor surgeries who do wonderful, wonderful jobs, but they don't have the technical skills and ability to run a major website on a trusted domain like NHS UK. And you will find hundreds of these small websites which are being run by the parish councillor's niece or nephew or, you know, the doctor's mate. And it's not good enough. Let alone, you know, who actually runs these things. So I've got a few simple tips that I think the government should adopt, and some of them, to be fair, I have reported all of these to the necessary people, and some of them have been really quick at taking them down, and others not. This is what I think needs to happen. So first is ownership. You know, who actually owns a domain? And that's actually a harder problem than it seems, and I'm sure you found that when you were saying, okay, well, we want to redirect this GovUK site to the main GovUK site. Well, who owns it? Who's responsible for it? The sites need to be updated and tested regularly, and that needs to be part of the, you know, the framework. We wouldn't expect someone to sort of put up a building and then say, okay, but you don't need any security guards and you don't need it to be inspected for building code violations or, you know, environmental health. You know, we need that with websites. The government should be saying, look, if you're running a website, we're going to security scan it and, take it away from you. That's the last point. But stop issuing GovUK. So I think I'm right in saying no one's allowed a GovUK website now, except in very limited circumstances. There might be one or two. Everything should be on the main GovUK, which is brilliant. But with the NHS, there's no rules like that. If you are vaguely related to the NHS, you can get an NHS UK website, and no one can tell you what to do with it. Now, the GovUK domain registry rules, I think, are changing, which says that if your GovUK website is spewing spam or is, in other words, otherwise insecure, I presume GDS or someone can claw it back. We also need that from the NHS, because at the moment we're in a situation which is despicable. It's really damaging for the infrastructure of this country. Not only are none of these sites, very few of these sites, protected by HTTPS, but so many of them are spewing malware and filth and dodgy pills and all sorts of horrible things like that. So next time you come across one of these dodgy websites, please write to your local MP or to, you know, someone else senior and get them to try and do something about this. Thank you very much.